Please listen carefully.
And now, live from the Zudio in McKinney, Texas, it's the Assuming Positions Podcast, featuring two guys flapping gums and being chums, Kevin and Mikey.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Assuming Positions Podcast. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And I am remote. I am not in the Zudio.
We are social distancing. Yes, you are locked down.
We're social distancing. And hopefully everyone else is too, because that's the only way we're going to get out of this is by not being around other people.
Very true.
So obviously all this craziness is happening, but we still want to be able to provide fun content for you to listen to. But because of all this craziness and us getting sent home from work and working from home and stuff, we haven't really been able to get together and just do a regular podcast. But we will be doing that using this remote technology in the future.
Yeah, we're sort of playtesting it right now. This is getting all the knots and kinks out of it, but we should be up and running. So hopefully this is fun.
So what we decided to do is that we're going to play you a best of. If you've been listening to our FenCon coverage, we mentioned what our favorite podcasts we've ever done were.
Yeah, what our favorite episodes were, yeah.
And I came up with the Evil Ted episode, which you could have just gone back and listened to. We realize that, but we want to give you something to listen to on Monday. So we're going to go ahead and replay that Evil Ted episode for you.
We're going to make you focus on it because we love it so much. Oh, it's great.
Yeah. And funny behind the scenes thing, I think I mentioned this here and there, but we're at ACON 2019. And we were interviewing him actually next to, in an empty booth next to his booth that was in this giant room in Fair Park in Dallas. That
had huge.
all the dealers in it, and it was packed and it was noisy. And I didn't have the right kind of headphones to close it off, so I was yelling.
It was a sort of one of our first forays into on the scene sort of recording. So there are a little bit of blips and bumps, but there were a bunch of people there. It was a great time, good energy. It was a good chat with him as well.
I was excited. He was at the time was the biggest, most famous person we ever got to interview on the podcast. So I was also a little nervous. So
he worked on Fifth nerves. Element. Oh, I was freaking out.
Yeah, right. Titanic even. Jeez Louise. So there was some excitement, some nerves, loudness. So you can get a chuckle at that because it gives me a chuckle to hear me yelling.
Oh, it's great. It was a fun time. Evil Ted is a great dude.
He's a great dude. He still follows us and helps retweet stuff. And we retweet stuff from him and follow him. And you should give him a follow.
Yeah, check him out on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all the platforms. He's always active on, I think, all of them.
He is. So without much further ado, we just want to tell you stay safe. Follow all the guidelines that are out there. We love every one of you for listening to us. And soon enough, we'll be out again, causing smiles and washing hands.
Washing hands and eventually shaking hands. Washing hands for now. But yeah, get to listening.
Hey, everybody, Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
Assuming Positions Podcast, mobile at ACON Dallas 2019.
Oh, and what a blast it is at ACON.
And we have run into the great, the wonderful, Evil Ted.
Evil Ted.
Hello, everybody. Rotten to the core, so evil.
So, Evil Ted.
Yes, sir.
You are a Hollywood professional, prop maker, modeler. You have taken your skills and you've just given them out to the cosplayers of the world. Just shared them with everyone. Yes. What motivated you to reach out to this great group of cosplayers? There's so many of them running around here at ACON. And share your skills with them.
Okay, well, it all started when I was 14 years old and I saw the movie Star Wars. And my mind was blown. Like most of that movie made much an impact because you have to understand, this is the 70s when nothing was like that ever since. And when you watch that movie to this day, it's almost timeless. The only thing it gives it away is the haircuts on Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford. Yeah. Kind of a little 70s vibe.
That's how haircuts are in the Star Wars universe,
Yeah, it's all 70s still. So I saw that movie and I was blown away. So I was like, oh, I want to know everything about it. And there was no books. There was no YouTube. I went to the library and looked at stuff. And there was like virtually nothing. I think it was in the library, a public library, school library. It was all about theater and theatrics and no movies. It was a complete foreign subject to me. It was just all magical mystery. And then it wasn't until the 80s the studios started realizing that, hey, people really like to know how things are done, and it won't ruin the magic if you talk about it. So they did a TV show called Movie Magic, and it blew up. People loved it. And they made a couple episodes, and then there was Cinefex came out, the magazine, all these behind-the-scenes things. So they started realizing there was a love for, like, people wanted to know how it was done. And so as a kid blowing up, I was like, ah, that's what I want to be. So I was so desperate, and I wanted to learn that as I got older and started working in the movie industry, I found myself being somewhat programmed by the industry, because we all have ticks and tips and techniques we do in the model shops and prop shops and costume world. And I got in this, I was 15 years in a prop house called HPR, Hand Prop Room. It was a great place to work. I learned so much. But it got to a point where anything, techniques that we did or used, we always kind of kept them a secret, because out of fear that our rivals would use them.
Oh, yeah.
And it was this whole kind of cutthroat thing about industry and losing work. And as soon as I got away from it, I started realizing, like, wait a minute, that's absurd. Like, if you think this little technique's going to really give you an edge over somebody else, it's asinine. Yeah. It's ridiculous. So I made a video for fun about how to make a foam helmet, and it blew up. And people were like, oh, we want to know more. And all of a sudden, a lightning bolt went off my head. I said, wait a minute, I'm doing this for the 14-year-old kids like me.
Because
I saw Star Wars. And these kids are seeing, like, video games or Fallout or some new movie or Star Trek. I'm like, hey, I want to make this costume. And I realized, wait a minute, I can be that guy. I want to help all the 14-year-olds out there. And so I kind of selfishly do it for me. It's like, I want to make it easy for the 14-year-old boy who sees something and blows himself away. I have to rephrase that. 15-year-old boy and girl.
Because
the cosplay girls are blowing up, too. And they're catching up. And they're mad crafters. And so that was my driving force, was that I thought about the 14-year-old boy, so I want to teach them. So.
That is awesome.
And the thing is funny is I realized if I had somebody like me when I was my age, I would have excelled. I would have done – I'm like – I'm pretty much self-taught, and it wasn't until I moved out to California in 1989. I started working around other professionals, and I was like, oh, wait. That's a technique. Ooh, that's a technique. And these guys are like, yeah, what I do is I do this. And it's no secret, because you're working together each other. But I would take that technique and like, ooh, I like that. And I would build on it. And I'd go to work in another shop. Work another guy goes, that's how we do this. I'm like, oh, that's great. And I started becoming a library of techniques. And it's sad. I forgot most of them. So they're slowly coming back to me. If I only could remember, I think I've forgotten more than what I know.
I forgot more.
It's kind of sad. But that is why I do it, because I'm just doing it for that 14-year-old Ted out there.
That is a noble, noble cause.
That is very awesome. And it's awesome to see that you also have skills in a variety. Like, looking at your IMDb page, it's model maker, it's prop maker, it's person in the monster costume, it's person doing makeup effects and visual effects. Where does the variety come from? Where did that start?
Oh, it's a roller coaster. I was just a kid. You know, I came out, and my answer to everything was yes. Like, you want to make this? All right, I'll make it. Like, I think back about the fear I used to have when I started off, and it's the more I worked, the more comfortable I became. But I was like, I met this guy, Steve Wang, and he was making this. I moved to California. I met him, and he was making this low-budget film called Kung Fu Rascals. And it was an uber-low-budget little film. He did it himself, and it took like 9 months to make. So I literally would work at a job, or I was working on Miracle Landing or some made-for-TV movie. And then in the weekends, I would work on Kung Fu Rascals. We'd shoot like 15 hours a day, and I would go to sleep for an hour, go back to work. But it was like, but I didn't care. I loved it. I wasn't getting paid.
Yeah.
We just loved it. And it got to a point where I was learning so much and hanging around these talented guys. And Steve got the gig to direct a movie called The Guyver. And it's like, and he said, hey, you want to work on this movie, The Guyver? I'm like, yeah, I do. So I got pulled onto that, and I worked with these other guys, and they go, hey, we need a monster. You want to play a monster, Ted? I'm like, hell yeah, I want to play a monster. So it's just that thing of just like, it was all about filmmaking. I just love movies.
Yeah.
It was the love of movies. And so it wasn't really a designated, like, it's just that funny thing of like, people used to say jack of all trades, master of none.
Mm-hmm.
I totally disagree. I think it's like when I build, I like doing multimedia and different materials, and when I was in the industry. But I got into foam because foam's cheap. And I try to make stuff, all my videos, I try to make sure that what I make in my videos that you could get at any local craft store or a hardware store. It's like I try to make it to where everything's readily available. So anything I do in a video, it's something you could do if you have access to any store around your neighborhood.
Yep. Yeah, well, we've watched your videos, and it makes me want to go buy a whole bunch of foam, that's for sure.
And while we're walking around ACON, we see at your booth, you have your Arya's dagger we saw that you made, and all your Borg helmet and all that cool stuff. So,
you know, it's funny that you mentioned, we went and saw your panel, and you were talking about Miracle Landing.
Yes.
And I'm old enough to have seen that on TV.
Right.
I remember seeing it, because I was like...
That was with the beautiful Connie Seliga.
Yeah, 1990, I think that came out.
Yeah, it was pretty early.
So I would have been, like, 16. And right. You know how stuff sticks in your head when you're a teenager?
Right.
I remember that movie. And when you were talking about it, people were getting excited that you're on The Fifth Element, you're on Titanic. I was getting excited that you did Miracle Landing, because I remember that movie.
That was my first big show.
Wow. Like,
I wrote my mom and dad about it. Well, and I'm like, Miracle Landing, yeah, woo! A made-for-TV movie.
Yeah.
And my first check from that job. Now, guys, you got to understand, this is 1989. I was working, and my first check, I got them, they handed it to me, it was $900. And I sat down and looked at it and went, oh, my God, I'm going to be rich. this is a check with my name on it for $900. And you have to understand, I came from St. Louis, Missouri, where I had a job, I was getting paid $350 an hour, okay? Yeah. And I pulled on a weekly salary, I had like medical and dental and all that stuff, but it was just a slow, boring, miserable job. And it just, it was ridiculous. Like, my rent was $350 for an apartment in St. Louis, all right? And that was a lot of money back then.
When
I moved to California, my apartment was $450, and that was tight. And I'm like, oh, man. But when I got that check for $900, like, oh, dude, I'm set. So, and I realized really quickly in the movie industry that you're a gypsy, because when the job's over, you're unemployed. So you're an independent contractor. I had no idea what that word meant until I experienced it. But you know something? I didn't care. I would just hit the pavement and start working again.
I dig it. I do have to jump. Kevin mentioned Fifth Element. I do have to speak up as the Fifth Element diehard. That's one of my top five sci-fi movies of all time. And to hear you tell a tale about it at your panel today was awesome. I was wondering if you could just give us an anecdote about working on Fifth Element, because it seems so interesting.
It was Luc Besson at the time, and I love Luc Besson. He did a really cool independent film. It was a small film called Le Dire Combat. It was a French film. It was a post-apocalyptic movie. It was his first one, and it was almost virtually silent. There was no dialogue except for one word. And I saw that film when I was really young. When I was back in St. Louis in the 80s, and it made an impact on me. I'm like, oh, my God. And I saw, he did other things. He did Subway. He did La Femme Nikita. And that really blew him up. And then all of a sudden, I'm working at this model shop, and they hired me this thing called Fifth Element. And they always, Luc Besson. I'm like, what? Luc Besson? Dude, and I start fangirling, talking, and everybody at the shop's looking at me like, what? Ooh, what? Yeah. Nobody saw those movies. And I was excited to work on it. It was an ambitious project for him to do. And we all worked on it. It was a hard show, and we worked on it. And then the weird thing was, we bust our asses, we got it. And so when it got released theatrically, it technically, studio by studio versions, bombed. It didn't do that well. It did okay, but not what they wanted.
Yeah.
So it kind of like, everybody, oh, well, Luc Besson made a stinker. And it goes to show you, I always tell people, Gone with the Wind bombed, Blade Runner bombed.
Yeah.
Big Trouble in Little China bomb.
Yeah.
We're talking bomb. Yeah. People talk shit about it when it came to the theaters. And now they're iconic films, and it's so happy. This film I worked on that did when it came out is now this iconic film that people love. That goes to show you, screw you, critics. It's the test of time.
It's true. It's the test of time. It's the people. And you were talking about how you were showing a picture of how one of your friends was putting the signs on. The
traffic signs.
The traffic signs, and how you never even really saw them, but I think, in my mind, that attention to detail when you're doing that a film, somehow, some way, that translates.
And I learned that from my friend Steve Wang. I used to give him shit about, he would sculpt and put such minute detail into these creatures and costumes and props, whatever he was working on, the detail where you could get up with a magnifying and just like look at it. Like, and he said, that's my MO. That's my brand. He goes, I don't make it so much for film. Is that when somebody picks up something from me that I made, they look at it and go, oh, that's him. That's Steve Wang. And I thought, oh, that made sense to me now. So if somebody picks up a prop or something that I build, you don't just want to build for camera. You want to build for you. Mm-hmm. You want to build the best you possibly can make it. And over time, it went on. He was absolutely right. When you start to compromise or cut corners on a prop or a costume, even for movies, even though you don't see it subconsciously, you do. Like, you go, it doesn't really look that great. But if you put the work on something that's really tight and amazing, it's on the screen for a couple of seconds, that shows subconsciously it shows. It does make a difference.
Right, right. And I think it must help the actors too if they're holding a prop looks so realistic.
And costumes and there's that's why it was a bit of a backlash because some of the actors when they were doing the Star Wars, I always tell people George Lucas was the first one to really start doing the green screen stuff. And you had these actors sitting on a soundstage looking at a tennis ball on a stick and going, this is the giant dragon. And they're like, okay, and action. Yeah. So these actors had to act, but they're really pulling for things. And Peter Jackson, when he did Kong, he made a full-size Kong head. Wow. He made a full-size Kong head and full-size Kong hand. So when these guys were on set, they had it on a gimbal and a rig. They could move it around very quickly. So these actors, like, okay, here's Kong. And they so these actors could see the head. They could kind of fill in the blank. Like, okay, right. This is giant bodies beyond that point. But he made a hand and a giant head. They were kind of positionable. But he did that for the actors. And I said, Peter Jackson got it, even though he still is king of the green screens as well, too. But that was something that I think makes a big impact for the actors as well.
Yeah, actors are good at playing pretend. But at some point, you need a little something to help them out.
They were when they did the Superman, the new Superman one that Zack Snyder did. Yep. The guy who played the villain, Carell, main bad guy, his suit was completely digital.
Wow.
No, he wore a gray mocap suit with dots on it. A couple of actors wore suits, but his suit was so crazy and so elaborate, they go, I will just do it in post. So the actors show up on set, and the only reason I know is because my friends do costume on the show. He was like, wait a minute, I don't get a costume? And he was really kind of irked about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because all these guys were dressed in these amazing costumes, and he's doing this performance. And he was kind of a little irked about it. Like, these guys got cool costumes. And they went back and did all the mocap on him. And when you watch the movie, you can't tell.
Yeah.
My friends who were costumers saw the movie. They saw a rough cut of Superman. They're like, holy crap, that looks real. Like, it really did.
But, you know, actors are nerds, too, and they stuff.
So
I know. They must love it sometimes. Have you ever gotten comments by anyone who's held a prop of yours and has been like, oh, this is so awesome?
Wow. I don't know. I think... The most thing I think I've made that was so iconic that people get a big kick out of was I made the Guyver unit for the movie The Guyver.
Yeah.
And when people found out I made it, like, oh, yeah. And then I actually have a replica at home. I have a casting from the original one, and I've drugged my sweet ass. I've never put it together. It's been, what, how many, 20 years, I think? Yeah. And I still haven't finished it. I'm going to eventually put it together. And it turned as I was doing it, Steve made his company put out a replica you could buy for $300. I'm like, done. I just bought it. And now I'm even less likely to put it together because I have a cool one he bought from his company that lights up and makes sounds. Because mine would probably light up but wouldn't make the sounds. But people just, when people, I show up, people, it's very iconic. They dug it. So
in the panel, you're saying how you've brought some of this foam work that you've been doing into your regular job, I guess we'll call it.
Yeah, I used to do that.
And, and you're telling that story about Star Trek and how they wanted an aluminum gun, and you're kind of like, foam?
Well, what happened was they pitched it, and the prop masters don't know better, and the stunt guys were asking, well, the stunt guys were like, we want some heavy-duty aluminum because that's to look cool. And I'm like, but stunt guys aren't prop, they're not prop builders, they're stunt guys.
Yeah.
I understand what they want because usually most weapons and things they bang and knock around. So they wanted this giant hand cannon in aluminum, but they don't realize it's aluminum and the scale was huge. So if you start, even though it's thin and it's aluminum, you start scaling up and adding pieces, it got really heavy. So we kept pitching to them. The design looked feasible to be vacuum form pieces and have the body be foam. So the top detail piece could be light pieces of vacuum form plastic and the main body could be foam. So we pitched it to our boss. He said, Lonnie. So Lonnie's like, I don't know. And then finally, they made the aluminum one, and he looked at it, and he picked it up and went, So Lonnie said, my boss said, yeah, let's make foam ones. So we did. And we did. The prop master didn't ask for them. We did. We did it for him. So we built these foam prop masters. We had them done, and Lonnie goes, I don't want the prop master seeing them. Make them next door. I don't want them seeing them. So I did. We made them. Some of the prop masters showed up, and then I picked up aluminum ones. They went, these are really heavy. Oh, we're really concerned. And they go, hey, can you bring yours one? And they bring them over, and they, these are much better. The stunt guy's like, yeah, we can use these. And so the prop master's like, are those give me? Are those gimmies? And Lonnie's like, nope. We're charging you for those.
That's
our funny, my funny story.
Yeah, it's a brilliant story, and it's neat to see that the techniques for you are going both ways now. You're bringing that foam into your prop making
right.
and your modeling and sharing it with people like the stuff that you can get at a hobby store. It's great.
It's cool. Yeah. And if you go to my website, evilTedSmith.com, I have some props listed there. I call them my foam props. And I did a tiki idol for Mad Men. There's an episode where a woman or somebody throws a tiki idol at somebody and they need a foam one the next day. And my boss is like, there's no time to mold it. And I'm like, I can make it. He's like, what? I go, you only got a day. I'm like, yeah, give me. So I cranked it out. And my boss, of course, you know, went and did his job, went away. And I made this thing and I cut it and sanded it and cut it and grind it and made a foam replica of the wood one, sealed it and painted it. And he came back the next day and goes, oh, you molded it. I went, no, I didn't. It was one, and that was my greatest attaboy ever in that shop. They pat me on the back for that one.
Wow.
Then it was like, and so you go to my website, you can see them side by side. One's foam, the one's wood. And I had a day to do it. And it,
wow.
And if it wasn't for foam, it wouldn't have been possible.
Wow. That is awesome. You are truly a talented artist.
Yeah, and just to go back to your YouTube videos again, like people may hear foam and they think of the foam they get in craft stores like you're talking about, but then you watch your videos and the process is so intense. You don't skip any steps. You go through, you're very thorough, you're very making sure everything, and is that a conscious thing or is that just how you work?
The thing is so funny is that when I started off, I watched other people's videos and they were very abbreviated and very edited or time-lapsed, and I kept thinking, am I supposed to do that? And I didn't really have the technology to do it. So I thought, well, I'll go into detail, but I won't go too long. And I'm just trying to edit around it. And by the time I made my first video, I'm like, that's a lot of, but I couldn't cut it down. So I thought I'll just throw it out and see what happens. And people started writing me back. I started getting waves of emails like, oh my God, you go into detail. We're so appreciative. So I thought, okay, that's my MO now from now on. So what I do now, though, I do my best by editing my videos down in the sense of like what I'm like, I describe what I'm doing and I start to cut, then I edit. Like, nobody used to see me put glue on 20 times. Or nobody sees me have to cut something out. Like, I just start to show them me start to cut and then have the piece already cut out.
Yeah.
Or I pre-cut stuff before the video because people know it's like to cut foam. So I try to steam run down that way because if I watch my early, I'll be honest, I can't watch my earlier videos.
Sounds like our earlier podcast.
Yeah, it's painful. So I just go, I'm just not going to go there. So when I do, I realize I try to make updated videos. I have tools of trade I made one. I did tools of trade 2.0, and I'm telling you, already within a couple of years, I got to do 3.0 because there's so much stuff I use now that didn't exist.
Oh yeah.
And there's so much new stuff coming out that I got to keep making more videos and tools of trade.
What's the best new thing that helps you out now? What's the best new thing that came
Rapid
out?
Rapid fill. There's a stuff called Rapid Fill. It's a acrylic based compound that you can apply to your foam, and if there's bubbles and cracks and crevices or weird seams, you put it and layer it up and you sand it.
Oh, cool.
And it's acrylic and it's flexible. So you can layer it up, sand it. And I've actually used it on one of my videos on how to make, I made it like a robot helmet and I wanted to test this stuff called Rapid Fill. And he made it mostly for just sealing foam without using plastic tip, just doing it, you know, just doing it, sealing it very, getting rid of all the bubbles in the foam to get rid of the foam texture. But I tried to use it to cover the seams and it worked really well. And now I'm really hooked on it. So I used that same stuff for Arya's Dagger.
Yeah, that's what we watched that one.
When Arya's Dagger, I brushed and coated like two or three coats, and I sanded it. And then when I sealed it, it went really smooth. So when I was able to paint silver on it, it made it look even more like metal. It was super smooth. Less like foam, more like smooth like metal.
Now, I'm into miniature gaming, so I paint a lot of miniatures. Mm-hmm. And when you did that technique where you painted the silver on and then the Tamiya clear red to make that jewel on there...
Right.
I was like, I am using that. If I have any gems or crystals or anything on any of my miniatures,
right.
I'm using that technique. So thank you for that, Ted.
So it's just, you put a chrome coat on it. Like, there's tons of little chrome paint, model paint. Let it dry, and then put a red clear on it.
Yeah.
They have red clear, yellow red. They have all the different colors of clear. And it's that chrome base is the trick. And then once you put the clear on it, and you can go let that clear dry, and it goes darker the more coats you put on.
It looked great.
I do want to talk on, speaking of your videos again, whenever you're working on a project, one of my favorite parts about it is something will not turn out how you were expecting or planned. And so you'll be like, well, this doesn't look how I like, but here's how we're going to adjust, here's how we're going to fix, and here's how we're going to progress forward. And you have that lends to a general outview of how you view failure. And if you could talk on that a second, I think you have a great outlook on that.
Yeah, failure is all part of learning. And I always tell people and when I mess up, I always try to leave it in the video because I think that's a downside if I screw up and then go back and fix it later, which is not saying I haven't done it in the past, but I always try to tell people that failure does sting, and it does for a reason. And if it didn't sting, then you wouldn't learn from it. But you've got to embrace failing because I have these people that come to my booth, and every concert I've started, even today, they all come to my booth and go, I'm really scared to start. I said, of course you are, because you want it to be perfect the first time you make it, and that's not going to happen. And the idea is that you've got to embrace the failure aspect of it, because that's the driving force of making it look good. I said, and the best part about it is when you make something that's pretty good, then you build something else, and you come back and look at it and go, I could have made that better. And that's the part. If you're wired to make something and you look at it, and you're not a skilled builder, but you know that what's wrong with it by looking at it, you're on the path to getting better, because that's the biggest step. A lot of guys build something, go, that's good enough. And if you're going to go through life saying that's good enough, it's never going to get any better. I have so many people, I've worked in the industry with people who consider themselves professionals, and they're like, that's good enough. Well, it's a low-budget movie, that's good enough. I'm like, yeah, but that's your name, that's your brand. You're putting something with your name on it, even if it's a low-budget film. And again, quote my friend Steve Wang, when you say yes to a job, doesn't matter what the budget is, if you agree to it, you committed to that job. So they go, hey, Ted, we need this. We haven't got a lot of money, but we want you to do this thing. And this project sounds like it's cool, then I'm in. And I just recently did my friend's doing a film called Jinji, The Book of Lies. It's a low-budget action adventure picture. And he did a Kickstarter, and he wanted this Roman sword. And I was like, dude, I'm in it. I'll do it. And he had no money. And I didn't care. I was like, I want to do this because it was a challenge for me. And I realized I was making things. Things didn't work. Like, oh, this doesn't look right. And I just kept at it. Because I realized when it's all said and done, it's going to be on a film. And it's going to be a close-up. And I know how he shoots. He's a really good director. So everybody's going to be good. The props, like all the costumes will be good. The actors going to be good. If my prop falls short of that, it's going to make the film suffer. So I'm becoming part of the team. So I'm part of this project. So I'm going to do the best I possibly can. And I did it. And when I handed the prop to him, I was so giddy because he looked at me and went, he said, I've never had anything this good in any of my films ever.
Oh, wow.
I said, you're such a great filmmaker. And so we've been such good friends that I have more things to build for him on this film too. But it's that no matter, again, if you say yes to something, do the best you can. So even if it's not a job, you commit to doing a costume, there's no money involved, you're doing this for yourself, why short-side yourself? Why cut yourself short? Don't start a costume 2 weeks before a con. If you want something that's going to be like, oh, my God, I want to go to BlizzCon, or I'm going to go to Anime Expo, and it's in like, then think about next year. Like, all right, I want to do this thing. It's going to start building. Take that time. So therefore, something doesn't work out, you have that time to make it. So when you show up the con, that costume, you can rock it because you put 100% of your talent into something.
Wow. I don't think there's any more to be said after that.
That is nerd passion firsthand.
That is
wonderful. I think that passion beautiful. Also carries over into your projects and the videos that you're putting out there and sharing with people. So
where can they find all your stuff, Ted?
Oh, my God, guys. You can go to my website, eviltedsmith.com. And also, when you go to the website, there's links for Instagram. And Instagram is evilted_channel. Twitter is evilted40. And there's Facebook, which is the Evil Ted website fan page on Facebook. And guys, all if you're a film fabber out there and you're new and you're intimidated and you come to my table and being afraid, there's a group I started on Facebook called the Foam Fanatics, and it's a really great friendly community where everybody shares techniques and ideas. And I started because when I stream live on Twitch, twitch.tv/EvilTedSmith, I stream every Monday and Tuesday from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. On those days, everybody shows up and they all talk among themselves, and I realize I need a format for them to be when I'm not streaming, because if I'm not streaming, they're not talking to each other. So I started that group and it took off, and it's 8,000 and growing. And what's so cool about it is that I do my fan mail once a week. So people write me questions. I do my best to get back to them as fast as I can. But if you're working a costume and you hit a wall and you're in the shop, you want to know the answer now. So you go to Evil Ted's Foam Fanatics and you write a question in there, you'll get a response within 15 seconds or 5 minutes, because it's international. So it's 2 o'clock in the morning where you are, but it's noon in Germany, you know? So it's like, and it's such a great community and everybody's all global. And that's what pulled me into this community, is that I love the fact that it's all about sharing techniques, and that I came from the movie industry that broke you guys, you, the cosplayers, you brought my love for building back. I got burned out. I was having fun in my 20s, okay fun in my 30s. It was getting kind of tiring in my 40s. And by the time I hit my 50s, it wasn't fun anymore. I was just cranking out shit for other people. And I was getting kind of burned out. And I left. And I started making videos. And I was like, wait a minute. The fun came back. you guys out there, you cosplayers, that community, you turned me back into that 14-year-old boy that I was, who loved building. So now I'm back to building again. Because when I worked at the shops, when I came home, the last thing I wanted to do was build something. But now it's all about building. And you guys watch my videos. You click on my Amazon links. You subscribe. You tell your friends. And that is why I'm here. You guys are having me travel. I'm in Texas because of you guys. I went to Germany because of you guys. It's like, I love it. So, again, it's my way of saying thank you. So I'm going to do my best to keep putting out quality product. Thank you so much.
That is terrific. Well, yeah, thank you, Ted, for sure.
Thank you, and we'll let everybody we know to tune into your channel and get on those videos.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Ted, for talking to us. So we want to thank Evil Ted for talking to us. That was a great interview.
Oh, a wonderful person to talk to.
You can find Evil Ted all over the place. He's all over the internet. On the socials, he's on Twitter at EvilTed40. He's on Instagram at EvilTed_channel. You can find him on Twitch, twitch.tv/EvilTedSmith.
Yep, on Twitch, he streams on Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Yeah, Pacific Standard Time.
We suggest looking at that. He also has a Facebook group called Evil Ted's Foam Fanatics, because as you just heard, foam is king.
Yep.
That's facebook.com/groups/EvilTed's Foam Fanatics.
Oh, yeah.
So check all that out from Evil Ted. You will want to build things after watching it. You can, I can assure you that. As for us, you can find us on the socials at AssumingPod, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you want to send us an email, you can Gmail us, assumingpositions@gmail.com. And we want to thank Jazzar for our music, That Guy Brad for our announcing, Not Scott Productions for our equipment. We want to thank you for listening.
And thank you for having a great time with us out at AECON 2019.
Yeah, we'll be back with more content next week.
Stay tuned.
Everybody, welcome to the Assuming Positions podcast. What did I say? Podcast.
Great start. Great start.
It's a podcast.
A podcast where we talk about nothing but penne and rigatoni and bow tie.
All right. Jeez Louise, out of practice, right?
It's been a minute.
Yeah. 5, 4, 3.